On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Drink up, me hearties, yo-ho.
And yo-ho to you. It's a pirate's life indeed. Pirates of the Caribbean 2, Dead Man's Chest, sailing into theaters everywhere this weekend. And Johnny Depp is back as the wild and weird renegade of the seas. None other than...
Jack Sparrow!
How much do you know about Davy Jones?
You owe me your soul. And it's time to pay up.
If there was anything could be done.
Well, there is a chest.
The dead man's chest.
To find it, you must sail to the end of the earth and beyond.
What is in the chest?
What is in the chest? Well, box office gold, of course, or at least Disney hopes so. The first Pirates movie pulled in $650 million. That's a treasure chest. The second could be just as big. Both movies tap into our romance and fascination with pirates. And a third is on the way. But piracy's actual maritime brigands were more bloody, brutal, and grimly fantastic than any swashbuckling scene on a Hollywood soundstage. And they're still at work on the high seas today. This hour on Point, we set sail beyond legend and lore to discover the real life of pirates. You can join the conversation. Have you been swept away by the romance of pirates? What's the allure of these murderers of the high seas? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Later this hour, we'll get a film critic's take on the new Pirates of the Caribbean 2. But first, joining me from London is David Cordingley. He's a former curator at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, England, and was historical consultant on the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. He's author of Under the Black Flag, The Romance and Reality of Life Among Pirates. David Cordingley, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Here we are, back and back and back again. It comes to the theaters. I mean, ever since Lord Byron and Robert Louis Stevenson and even a bit of Robinson Crusoe, we just never get tired of this pirate lore, in spite of the fact, as you point out in tremendous detail, these were gruesome, bloody, sadistic murderers, rapists, plunderers, and all the rest. What's the romance of all that blood?
Well, I think it's the books and particularly the movies that have made them romantic, really. And it's partly because piracy took place in exotic places, mostly in the West Indies, and people living in cold climates sort of dream of tropical islands and all that sort of stuff. But I think it's down to partly Treasure Island and the films that have been made of Treasure Island and those great pirate movies, the Errol Flynn ones in particular, which created a sort of romantic, heroic view of pirates that really had absolutely nothing to do with the real thing, but is, you know, it's good for us to dream about, but don't let's kid ourselves that that's what the pirates were really like.
We're going to look at what they're really like, what they were really like, and a bit of what they're like today, but the romance has been there again and again. Let's listen. Here is Errol Flynn as Captain Blood in 1935, dedicating his life to piracy.
We, the undersigned, are men without a country. Outlaws in our own land and homeless outcasts in any other. Desperate men, we go to seek a desperate fortune. Therefore, we do here and now band ourselves into a brotherhood of buccaneers to practice the trade of piracy on the high seas. We, the hunted, will now hunt.
And always the water lapping from Davy Jones' locker. David Cordingley, you write that piracy has been around just about as long as people floated on water. Julius
yeah.
Caesar hijacked by pirates in the Aegean or somewhere over in that area.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, but the Great Age, really what they call the Golden Age, as you say, this West Indies period, what was that period? Why is it seen as the Golden Age, quote-unquote, of piracy?
Well, it was a period, really, when piracy in the West Indies suddenly sort of erupted out of nothing. There'd been lots of wars in Europe, and the wars had finished, and a lot of out-of-work sailors. And most pirates were, of course, former sailors, because you had to be able to be a decent sailor to work a ship. And from about 1715 onwards till about 1725, it's quite a narrow period, about 20 years, the pirates became such a menace in the Caribbean that the colonial governors were complaining to London and the merchants were complaining, and ships couldn't go in and out of Port Royal or any of the West Indian Islands without getting intercepted by pirates. And it's reckoned there were something like 2,000 of them roaming around in the Caribbean around that time.
And they became a plague ultimately to the British, but the British had a hand in getting piracy started with their privateers, Spain and Portugal, ahead in the race to sail the seas and claim new territory, and had the Pope blessing the Spanish bull and all that, sort of giving the new world to them. When the English first sent their sailors out, they were practically as pirates, were they not, privateers?
Well, you're right. I mean, what is interesting is that one of our great naval heroes, Sir Francis Drake, actually spent the first 20 years of his life being an out-and-out pirate. I mean, he was raiding Spanish treasure ports on the Spanish main. He was intercepting Spanish treasure ships, often at a time when England was at peace with Spain. And the Spanish ambassador got terribly upset about it. But it's a nice touch, I think, that having gone around the world and come back with a ship laden with about $60 million worth of treasure, he was knighted on the deck of his ship by Queen Elizabeth I. So I think England always likes that sort of swashbuckling hero.
Was he sanctioned from the get-go? I mean, you write these, you convey the stories of him. We think of the heroic Francis Drake, but here he is sort of crouched in the jungle waiting for Spanish mules to come with silver on their backs. Did he have the Queen's blessing when he began to go after these treasures?
No, not at all. I mean, Drake and Sir John Hawkins were really freelance mercenaries at that stage. They weren't operating for the British Navy at all. They were simply out there like adventurers just to earn as much money as they could and to come back and make their mark, you know. But subsequently, I mean, Drake becomes an admiral in the British Navy, and he helps defeat the Spanish Armada and becomes a real, you know, one of Britain's four or five great naval heroes.
Now, we've got to define some of our terms here. The Spanish Main, we always hear about it, but what exactly was the Spanish Main?
Well, it was really the mainland of what is now Mexico and northern South America, that sort of great... The mainland on the west of the Caribbean Sea, that was the Spanish Main.
So the pirates were looking for the gold, which would be coming out of Peru, coming out of Mexico, onto galleons, headed back to Spain. That was prime target number one, but I'm also reading here where many pirate attacks would come up with nothing more than sort of an extra anchor chain and, you know, some more, I don't know, a few more barrels of rum.
Well, yeah, the thing was, you see, that the pirates, obviously, their aim was to capture a treasure ship. Then they could make their fortune and retire and get drunk for the rest of their life. But they also had to keep the ships going in an area in the Caribbean where there were deserted islands and you know, they couldn't go into any old port because they'd be hanged as a pirate. So they often attacked merchant ships simply to stock up on food and drink and basic sort of maritime supplies, ropes and anchors and that sort of thing. So, you know, they had to be self-sufficient in an area that wasn't, you know, full of ports supplying them with food and drink.
Buccaneer. This is something between a pirate or a privateer, or maybe it covers both, but what's the origin of the word, buccaneer?
Well, it comes from the boucan, or the boucanier. It was the barbecues that the Indians in the Caribbean used, but it applies really to the pirates of an earlier period, King Charles II's period, the 1660s. And Sir Henry Morgan was the greatest of the buccaneers. He attacked Portobello and he attacked and burned to the ground Panama. I don't know, that's the period which we call, you know, the buccaneering period. And then it's the later one, you know, 30 years later, when you get the golden age of pirates and you get Blackbeard and Calico Jack and the female pirates and all that.
We'll look at that. But they went from semi-respectable, in the case of Drake and Henry Morgan, to pure rascals later on. Henry Morgan, here he is, you know, taking Panama and, as you say, Portobello, but he ends up his life, again, knighted by King Charles II. He's a planter in Jamaica, governor of Jamaica, wealthy, respected, maybe dropped into Port Royal now and then for a little more ribaldry, but in pretty good stead.
Well, absolutely right. And, I mean, I think the thing was that he was recognized as being a rather valuable force against the Spanish or the French, because during the 17th, 18th century, those West Indian islands were always changing hands. I mean, they were the source of tobacco and sugar and all sorts of riches. And so somebody like Morgan sitting in Port Royal, Jamaica, would obviously... prevent any French attack or Spanish attack. And the British at that period were almost perpetually at war with Spain. And so Morgan was good to have around, really.
There's a lot we've got to learn here. But number one, walking the plank. It scarcely happened. What's up with that? It's the central icon.
Well, yeah, I know. It's very mysterious, the walking the plank thing. I think it's all down to Peter Pan, really, and the fact that... Captain Hook threatened to make the Lost Boys and Peter Pan himself walk the plank. And it was sort of taken up by the movies, and every pirate movie always has a walking the plank sequence in it. And you know how it is. People tend to believe what they see on the screen or read in books. And I could only find in all my research one account of walking the plank. And, you know, there's absolutely no point in it, really. A pirate just wanted to raid a ship, torture anybody to find out where they left all the valuables, and then be off. There was no point in going through this slightly bizarre ceremony.
Mr. Cordingley, there's a lot we want to know. Let's just go right down the list. First of all, those garish costumes we always see them dressed in, is that just a
yes.
Hollywood makeup closet, costume closet, or is that the real deal?
No, they usually get it right, actually. The pirates tended to... dress up in clothes that they captured from, you know, wealthy merchants and passengers on ships, and the richer the costume, the better. So they tended to wear a sort of rag bag of clothes with, you know, silks and gold chains and things. But the basic pirate uniform would be just like a sailor's uniform. I mean, it would be trousers rather than knee breeches, mostly, because that's what sailors had in those days, and a short jacket. But and a handkerchief round the head is absolutely right. And they did have gold earrings very often. That was a sailor's thing. Mm. And sailors and pirates did collect parrots. So they were a sort of exotic souvenir you could bring back to impress your wife or
girlfriend. It's not just Long John Silver with the parrot. Real pirates with parrots on their shoulders. Why?
Oh, yeah. No, I found a lot of accounts of sailors and pirates bringing back to home port a parrot on their shoulder, often several. And if you could teach them to whistle and to swear, even better.
What about the eye patch, the peg leg, the hook? Is this more J.M. Barrie and Peter Pan or something else?
Yeah, no, I think the hook is entirely down to Peter Pan, really. But a lot of pirates would have had wooden legs. I've had peg legs. I discovered quite a few who did. And simply because sailing a ship was a dangerous business, and particularly if you were not only sailing, but you were attacking other ships. And so sailors and pirates lost limbs. And if you met a pirate, he would be... You know, he would be sunburned, but he would also be scarred. He might have lost a finger or two. He might have lost an eye and one or two lost legs. So that's perfectly accurate, that picture.
Now, the eye patch, I don't know what's just legend and what's real here. I read somewhere the pirates wore an eye patch, even if they had two eyes, because it would keep one eye accustomed to the dark. If they had to dash below decks for more dastardly deeds, they'd just swap the patch over and one eye would be ready to go in the dark. True, false?
Well,
you know?
I've heard that. It sounds a really good reason for doing it. And it makes sense, actually. But I've got no sort of evidence that that is the case. But I think somebody with a patch on their eye simply looks rather sinister. I expect that was the reason, really.
All right, what about the armory here? Flintlock pistols, swords and sabers, and what was the standard kit?
Well, the cutlass was the favoured weapon, really, because a cutlass was a short, sharp sword you could use easily on a deck. And they tended not to have the rapiers that you see Errol Flynn and people
the long, slender sword in the long, long duel on the huge deck.
No, that's really the movies. It would be a cutlass, it would be a dagger, it would be the flintlock pistol, and they did have boarding axes too, which was a sort of tomahawk, which was fairly effective in action. And they also, actually, when they came into attack, they used a primitive form of hand grenade, and they would throw these hand grenades onto the deck of the victim, and it would cause such sort of chaos and alarm that usually the people surrendered straight away.
The ships themselves, fairly small, often a sloop, not the great grand vessels we often see in the movies. What was there a standard vessel for the pirate or whatever they could get their mitts on?
No, The pirate ships came in all shapes and sizes, really. It depended, because obviously a pirate, you know, had to capture a ship to begin his career. So it depended which ship they captured. And the successful pirates would sort of trade up and get, you know, with one ship they'd attack another ship and get bigger and bigger. And people, the really successful people like Bartholomew Roberts and Blackbeard had 40-gun ships, which were not as big as some of the naval ships, but were formidable. But your average pirate ship was a single-masted sloop, a sort of what we call a gaff cutter today, with a big crew. I mean, they, you know, often several hundred people crammed into relatively small ships.
I've got to pepper you with a couple more of these, then we'll look at some of the great pirates. But treasure maps, they're in every story. Did they keep a map locked around their neck at all times?
No. I think the treasure map is a complete fiction, really. And it's really down, once again, to Robert Louis Stevenson and Treasure Island, when, in a way, the whole story is based around the treasure map and looking for the buried treasure where X marks the spot. And that story was so popular, I mean, just every child read it, that it became, the treasure map became associated with pirates thereafter. And there are very few examples of pirates actually burying treasure. I mean, the most famous example is Captain Kidd, who did bury some treasure on Gardner's Island outside New York. But by the time he'd been executed in London, most of the treasure had been recovered. So I think people still digging for it are not going to find very much.
You're right. They didn't want to bury it. They wanted to get to Port Royal or Tortuga, someplace where there were wenches and grog, and spend it.
Yeah, exactly.
What about grog and the whole liquor thing? I mean, I read again and again, and in your book, that these guys seem so soused, and the women, we'll talk about that, who were pirates. How did they ever pull off a decent attack? They seem to be drunk all the time.
Well, the thing was that before an attack, obviously the secret was not to be drunk, really, and to, you know, behave as reasonably well-disciplined crew. You then attacked a ship, ransacked it, and most of the ships travelling in the Caribbean would have beer and rum on board, and then you'd sail to some deserted beach, crack open the barrels of rum, and then get completely plastered. And often they made a big thing of it. They would fire the guns as they and drink toasts with Dan, with King George, and all that sort of stuff, and get completely drunk. And people who were captured by pirates were astounded by the amount of time they spent being drunk, and also by their foul language and obviously their sort of casual brutality as well.
We'll talk about that. Skull and crossbones, the flag. Did anybody fly that? What does Jolly Roger mean anyway?
Well, there are lots of theories about the Jolly Roger. One is that it comes from Jolly Rouge, meaning a pretty red flag, and some of the early pirate flags were red.
What did a red flag mean if you were flying?
Well, it meant no quarter. It meant that, you know, if I'm flying a red flag and I capture your ship, you are going to die.
So surrender right now, you might have half a chance.
Exactly, absolutely. But around about the 1700s, the pirates in the Caribbean seemed to have come up with this bright idea of having a recognisable pirate flag. And originally it was black with some sort of symbol on it, like a skull or a sword, cross swords or sometimes what do you call it? The thing that you tell the time with, so that it was limited time and surrender immediately. And then gradually the skull and crossbones became established, and the pirates found it useful to have a symbolic flag that was immediately recognisable, so that when they went into attack, they flew up the Jolly Roger, and immediately that was sort of a terrifying symbol. And the merchant ship would hopefully surrender without a fight.
And Lord knows, if they didn't, the tortures were, well, almost unspeakable, but we'll get to some of them. Here's the new Pirates of the Caribbean. David Cordingley was a consultant on the first one. Now here's Captain Jack Sparrow in the new one, conniving his way out from under the sword of Commodore Norrington.
Do excuse me while I kill the man who ruined my life.
Be my guest.
Let us examine that claim for a moment, former Commodore, shall we? Who was it that at the very moment you had a notorious pirate safely behind bars, saw fit to free said pirate and take your dearly beloved all to itself? Eh? So whose fault is it really that you've ended up a rum pot deckhand what takes orders from pirates?
Enough!
Unfortunately, Mr. Turner, he's right!
Still rooting for you, mate.
Well, all right, very fey, this pirate Jean Ledep. We'll talk about that. Bruce is calling from Bamberg, South Carolina. Hi, Bruce, you're on the air.
Oh, hey. I wanted to ask your guest if he ever knew Patrick O'Brien.
The author of so many great novels of the British at sea. And what about him,
Bruce?
Yes,
I did.
Did
yes,
you really?
I met Patrick O'Brien on two occasions at the National Maritime Museum. I actually showed him around the museum there, and he was very famous at the time, and I must say I was rather in awe of him, really.
Master and Commander, the movie that came out of that huge number of books. What's your question out of all that, Bruce?
That's where I learned most of my facts about seafaring and pirates. And one of his novels was called Letter of the Mark.
Which, yes.
Jack Aubrey actually was given, like you were asking before, authority to capture Spanish and French ships, you know, whoever they were at war with. The series of novels is so amazing, is the detail. I've never ran across any other novel, fiction, or that had so many facts in it that seemed to be authentic.
Lots of research there. Yeah. I have to admit, I was a prisoner of those novels for some time. And Letter of the Mark, David Cordingly, that the sort of letter that says you've got more permission from the crown to be a privateer.
Yes, it was. In a way, a letter of mark allowed you to be a sort of licensed pirate. And it only happened during a time of war. And it saved the nation building up a huge navy. And in fact, what they did was to give a letter of mark, which was a sort of solemn legal document, authorizing a merchant sea captain and his crew to attack an enemy merchant ship or enemy warships, and that's exactly what happened to Jack Aubrey. But going back to what your listeners were saying, I there's no doubt that Patrick O'Brien did the most amazing research for those books, and everybody I know, every naval historian, admires his work and feels that he really gives the atmosphere of that period, the Nelson period. And he's always absolutely right on the detail of his ships and the ceremonies and the behavior of the seamen. It's absolutely spot on.
Now, Bruce is calling from South Carolina. The Carolinas were home to no small number of pirates. The shore there, Blackbeard, Edward Teach, among them. Let's look at a few of these. What's his history? What's his story?
Well, Blackbeard really doesn't deserve to be quite so famous because he didn't kill so many people during his lifetime as somebody like Bartholomew Roberts. He was born in Bristol. He came out to the West Indies, did a bit of pirating, and then he gathered a little sort of flotilla of ships and started raiding the American coast. And it was when his raid on South Carolina, on Charleston, South Carolina, really upset the local people there. And it was decided to send a naval ship to track him down. And in fact, Blackbeard really becomes famous through the manner of his death, because he was tracked down off Ocracoke Inlet and by a heroic naval lieutenant called Robert Maynard, who sneaked up on him at dawn. And there was a tremendous duel on the deck of Blackbeard's ship, in which Blackbeard eventually went down with his head cut off, and he was thrown overboard, and they say that his body swam three times round the ship.
And his head?
The rest of the crew, without his headless. But the rest of the pirates were rounded up and were taken to Williamsburg and were eventually hanged from an oak tree in Jamestown.
And how about, you mentioned Bartholomew Roberts, Black Barty. What's his story? Mm. Where did he roam?
Well, he was Welsh. He was by far the most successful of the pirates of what we call the Golden Age of Pirates, and is reputed to have captured something like 400 ships in his lifetime. And I've read numerous accounts from the period, and he keeps popping up in them. He raids up and down the coast of America, up as far as Nova Scotia. And then he went across to the African coast. And it was there that he was, the Navy was actually dispatched specifically to track him down because he'd been such a menace. And he was tracked down by a naval ship commanded by Captain Chaloner Ogle, and who intercepted Black Bart's ship off Cape Lopez on the African coast. And there was a tremendous sea battle which took place in a thunderstorm. And Bartholomew Roberts was actually killed during the action, but the rest of the crew were captured. And Within a week, 52 pirates had been hanged along the coast of Africa. So they made a big example of his crew.
Black Barty is said to have taken more than 400 ships. And what about the women pirates? Who were they? What's that story?
Well, that's a really... I didn't really believe in them until I found that they again appear in the Boston Gazette and in various documents of the time. They're very complicated story, but which I can't go into, but Anne Bonny was basically Irish and Mary Read came from London. They ended up, extraordinarily, on the same ship of Calico Jack Rackham, who was a sort of small-time pirate operating in the Caribbean. And they went pirating with him and... eventually, they were tracked down off the coast of Jamaica, the West Coast, and were brought to trial. And there was a separate trial. The male pirates were tried on one day, and then the Mary and Anne Bonny were tried a week later. But very cunningly, they'd managed to get pregnant between being captured and actually being put on trial. And, of course, you couldn't... They were found guilty of piracy. There were plenty of witnesses to prove that they'd been ferocious and... as ferocious as the men, it was said, but you couldn't hang somebody with an innocent unborn child in them, and so they actually got a reprieve. Mary Read sadly died in prison, but Anne Bonny sort of disappears from sight, and it is said that she subsequently married somebody in the Carolinas and had children, and there are relations alive to this day from her, but I don't know whether that's true or not.
And weirdly, both these female pirates, we don't have time to get into it, but both, as I read it, had been raised as boys. 1983, the movie version of the classic Gilbert and Sullivan musical, The Pirates of Penzance. Here, Frederick Rex Smith asks the pirate king, Kevin Kline, to turn his back on high crime on the high seas.
Accompany me back to civilization.
No, Frederick. I don't think much of our profession,
but contrasted with respectability, it is comparatively honest.
No, Frederick, I shall live and die a pirate king! Yeah!
For to live and die under the brave black flag I fly, then play a sanctimonious part with a pirate head and a pirate...
Oh, hibbity-jibbity, it's all great fun, but it's all about blood and murder as well. Steve's calling from Orlando, Florida. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you know, Steve?
Oh, my favorite pirate role of all time has to be Tim Curry as Long John Silver in The Muppet Treasure Island.
Pirate puppets, what about him?
He was hilarious and at the same time brought this tragic dignity to a role that you would never expect in a Muppet movie.
And there it is, Pirate Puppets, the Muppets, and Tim Curry as Long John Silver. Steve, thanks for your call. David Cordingley, it's a long arc here from the very first accounts of these pirates by a Captain Johnson, quote-unquote, only a little while after they'd been on the seas, then to Lord Byron turning them into romantic figures, and then all the way to Muppets and Disney World, and you consulting on Pirates of the Caribbean. What an arc. How's it changed, the portrayal?
Well, it changes sort of subtly, really. I mean, Captain Johnson's famous History of the Pirates, which was a bestseller in its day.
In 1724.
Mm-hmm. And it had that in a way made that sort of golden generation of pirates famous, and that's where Blackbeard appears first, and Calico Jack and Bartholomew Roberts and Captain Kidd and everybody. Mm. They're all recounted there. And then gradually, during the course of the 18th century, people start making plays based on Captain Johnson's stories. So you get on the London stage plays of Blackbeard and plays of various famous pirates. And then you get Treasure Island, a whole series, really. There's Coral Island by R.M. Ballantyne. And then, of course, Peter Pan, which is a huge success, you know, becomes a sort of international success. And pirates, obviously, are the main point of that. And Gilbert and Sullivan, as you've just shown. Mm. And so it goes on. And then you've got the movies. And so the thing's moving further and further away, really, from the original pirates. And the legends and the myths are getting sort of built in all the time.
What do you make of Johnny Depp's Jack Sparrow as a pirate captain? Where does he take it?
Well, I mean, I think he's tremendous. I mean, I thought he made the first film, really, because I thought the plot was a bit sort of crazy, really. And in fact, the plots of most pirate films are they seem to be dreamt up by committees, really. They just pile in everything they possibly can. But Johnny Depp, I thought, was sensational in that first pirate movie. And I haven't seen the second one, but I'm sure he'll be sensational in that. And he gets the accent right, and he has a sort of a jokey but sinister appearance. And,
is it over the top in the way a historical pirate would recognize, or is this a kind of Hollywood version of Gilbert and Sullivan? I mean, the coal black eyeshadow and the super elaborate costume. Would he look like a weirdo in real pirate company, or like the real
pirates,
deal?
No, I think pirates did like dressing up, and you get somebody like Bartholomew Roberts, who is described as really, you know, quite a showman. He used to wear very dashing clothes and feathers in his hat and a red waistcoat and everything. So, no, I think that the appearance of the pirates in the Pirates of the Caribbean is absolutely right. They look authentic, and they're not all clean and tidy. I mean, they look like they've been through the wars a bit. So I don't have a problem with that at all.
Take us to the nitty-gritty. Hollywood does dress it up, but the tortures were unbelievable. I remember reading one from your book. Was it the Spanish Grand Dame of Portobello or Panama, stripped naked, in an empty wine cask, which was then filled with gunpowder, the pirate threatening to put a match to the whole thing. I don't know how that ended, but what about the tortures?
Well, that ended all right, actually. She got away with it. But in fact, they were quite ingenious about tortures. I mean, I won't go into all of them in great detail, but there were fairly standard ones, like putting lighted fuses under people's fingernails or between their fingers, and something called woulding, which was very effective, which you simply wound a cord round somebody's head across where the eyes are. Yes. Then you put a stick through it and tightened it up.
Ah.
And that usually worked.
Until, you pop the eyes or what happens?
Well, exactly. Well, until your skull caved in, really.
Ouch.
But I guess you sort of surrendered before that.
What was the point of these tortures? I mean, you've got one where they nail the man's intestines to the mast and make him dance with burning logs until they reel right out. Why? Was this just sadism or something?
That's about the nastiest, yeah. I think you managed to pick out just about the nastiest, really.
Sorry.
I mean, they also used to cut off... that's all right. They used to cut off ears and noses as well.
Why?
There were two separate things. First of all, there was torture in order to find out where people had hidden the valuables on a ship. And people were quite ingenious about hiding their valuables. But there was also, there's absolutely no doubt about it, a sadistic element. And there were a lot of pirates. And after all, they were criminals, let's face it. They were outside the law. And some of them were out and out sadists. And they enjoyed cutting people's ears and noses off. And, it gave them a bit of a kick.
And they could. So they did. Who were these guys? Who became pirates? We know they had some seafaring skill, but who were they?
Well, they were mostly out-of-work seamen. It was simple as that. If you were a seaman, it was your one trade, and when there were no wars to fight or there weren't enough jobs on merchant ships, then you simply grabbed a ship from a harbour and you set up as a sort of freelance pirate. And because you, in order to capture another ship and to capture what it got, you had to use violence. So it went on, and they tended to... There was a sort of downward spiral. They would, start drinking and using violence, and they got worse and worse until, in the end, they were captured and hauled before a court and hanged.
You've got the sketch here of Captain Kidd in a sort of metal cage, his body hanging at the mouth of the Thames, to say to one and all, do not do this. Let me take a call from Spokane, Washington. Carrie is on the line. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm very impressed with you and your show. You do your homework.
Oh, thank you, Carrie. What do you know?
You reminded me, I used to watch Errol Flynn all the time in California years ago.
Yeah.
That was wonderful. Loved his acting.
Yeah.
Loved Johnny Depp in Black Pearl. I think he did a great job. The tongue-in-cheek captured me.
Pretty wild.
I'm wondering what your guest knows about contemporary pirates. We hear bits and pieces about Caribbean pirates and some cruise ships and Indian Ocean pirates. How many are there? Any of them caught? And is this becoming a new lifestyle?
It's a great question. Well, I dipped into the headlines, David, and there's all kinds of reports here. I see over the last decade, piracy up by 168% by one count.
Yes.
Where's it going on? What's it like? What are the concentrations?
Well, really nothing has changed, and it's really, really serious in the South China Seas and the Malacca Straits, and because Singapore is now one of the biggest seaports in the entire world, and you get a huge number of vast ships are waiting outside Singapore Harbour. And then what happens is that the pirates come out from the Indonesian islands in fishing boats with powerful motors, and they attack at night, and they come up under the radar of the big ships when they're moving slowly or are actually lying at anchor. And they shin up the side with a bamboo pole or just hurl a grapnel on board. And I'm told by the people who've done research on all this that they are often in and out in 20 minutes or so. They simply put a gun to the captain's head, make him open the ship's safe, grab everything in the safe, take anybody's valuables and their Rolex watches and everything, and then they're back on their ship and back to the islands before anybody can raise the alarm.
Yeah, I've seen that. You know, a few years ago, I was on a tramp steamer from Balikpapan on the backside of Borneo, sailed down to Surabaya in Java there, into that harbor, arrived in the middle of the night, and we were all sort of sleeping on the deck, and the captain and crew made us all sort of huddle in the middle in full defensive crouch because they said, we're going to have people racing across the deck of the ship, grabbing whatever they can. What about bigger league piracy?
Well, there is, there has been. I think they've more or less put a stop to this. But there was a phase 10 years ago when there was a sort of Mr. Big operating from China, it was believed, who had a whole syndicate of pirates, and he sent them out in fast speedboats. And what they used to do was to capture a big ship that had got a valuable cargo. They would then falsify the paper, sail it into a port, unload the cargo and take the whole lot of the cargo, then reload it, and then sail that on to the next port, having, you know, falsified the papers all the time, and then make a killing with, you know, a lot of electrical goods and stuff, and then often then just let the ship loose at sea and let it drift around, being a menace to navigation.
We heard about this attack off Somalia not long ago on a private sailing boat. Are there no-go areas for yachtsmen these days?
Well, there are. I mean, yachtsmen are warned that certain areas of the world, particularly, of course, the South China Seas and Malacca Straits, and also the approaches to the Red Sea, there are certain areas where pirates are known to be lurking. There are quite regular attacks in the Caribbean on yachts in the more remote islands, and that is piracy. I mean, the people are just capturing the yachts, and there have been cases of people being murdered on their yachts. And also off the coast of South America, off the coast of Africa, certain areas, piracy is going on all the time. But in the South China Seas, that area, it is just getting worse and worse, and it's, you know, there are more attacks each year.
And yet the romance doesn't die. Even as the blood flows, the romance stays alive on Hollywood screen. David Cordingley, it's been wonderful talking with you. Thank you for sharing so much legend, lore, and real history with us today. It's been just great to have you. Thanks for being aboard.
It's a pleasure.
David Cordingley, author of Under the Black Flag, The Romance and Reality of Life Among Pirates. He joined us from London. In a moment, a closer look at Johnny Depp and Pirates of the Caribbean 2. This is On Point. Pirates of the Caribbean 2, Dead Man's Chest, opens everywhere tonight. Johnny Depp is back as that greasy rogue. Captain Jack Sparrow, Keira Knightley, and Orlando Bloom also return. The first Pirates movie, the 2004 Curse of the Black Pearl, netted a load of box office booty, $654 million worldwide. Hollywood would love to see another huge hit for the Pirates franchise, but some critics say the film fails to live up to the hype. To see if Dead Man's Chest can overcome the curse of the sequel, we're joined from New York by Lisa Schwartzbaum, movie critic for Entertainment Weekly. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. A pleasure to be here.
My gosh, I'm reading your review here. You're talking about rum-soaked Hardee's and facial pasta. What's up with this number two?
Well, the facial pasta belongs to the new nemesis that Johnny Depp faces. He faces Davy Jones, who kind of rules the undead under the sea. And Bill Nighy, the great British actor Bill Nighy, plays a kind of character with squid-like octopus things coming off his face. He plays a very jolly enemy for this movie. He is the latest kind of big blockbuster character to be brought in, since obviously we already know Johnny Depp and Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley, and the producers just want to keep the thrills rolling. Now, I think when you talk about critics who are having a bit of problem with this, it's not so much that we don't love thrills, because we do, but there is a certain sense of lack of feeling to this, that the producers are just throwing things at us for over 2.5 hours.
Lisa, don't light your cannon yet. I want to listen to just a little bit here. Here's Captain Jack Sparrow trading away Will Turner's soul to the ghoulish, octopus-headed Davy Jones.
I keep the boy 99 souls, son. But I wonder, Sparrow, can you live with this? Can you condemn an innocent man, a friend, to a lifetime of solitude in your name while you roam free?
Yep, I'm good with it. Shall we seal it in blood? I mean, ink.
Billy Nye and Johnny Depp there as Davy Jones and Captain Jack Sparrow. Lisa Schwartzbaum, you write that you weren't that crazy about the first one, but by the comparison, the first one was a thing of balletic grace, theatrical richness of character, and self-effacing economy of action. What's happened here?
Well, I was pretending to be a pirate and kind of waving my sword there. But in fact, one of the things that was striking about the first one was that Jack Sparrow was a new character. Mm-hmm. So we'd never seen Johnny Depp quite playing this before, and he was so striking and so charming in his craziness that we were sort of enchanted even when the movie rattled on and on. Now we know what he does. The producers know we know what this movie does. And as I began to say, they just keep loading and loading and loading action sequences as if we need to be constantly, constantly stimulated like little kids. Now, on the ride, you know, this is based on a Disney ride. Mm. The ride lasts a few minutes. This is over 2.5 hours. That's a very, very long time to be strapped in.
What about Mr. Depp? Does he pull it off again, that sort of weird, crazy, lovable charm?
He does. Mr. Depp is more charming than ever. I believe he also has more eye makeup than ever. He has,
ooh, that must be a lot.
It's quite a lot, and he is in full glory, and he does his thing. But as I said, we know what his thing is now. So in fact, you know, mentioning Davy Jones, he becomes the most interesting part of the movie, at least to me, because he is a fresh face of squid-like pasta.
Squid-like pasta, and Johnny Depp, as you have it here, cranked up into an exotic kaja-faux bird of even fancier lip twitches, wrist curls, and rouged feathers. But he doesn't carry it for you. What about for the kids? It's longer than the last one, 2.5 hours nearly. Are the kids going to love this?
Oh, yes, of course. You know, there's no question this is going to do phenomenally well at the box office. That's not the issue, and people are going to love it. So on the one hand, you could say, what does it matter what the critics say? It is interesting to point out that this is the kind of entertainment we're given. Now it's the idea that we just need stimulation and no emotion. Yes, it will make money, and people will think that they are entertained, but in fact, there is something lacking in this. There is a kind of hollowness to it that I wish I could. I got more out of Superman than I did out of this.
And part three already in the can. Does this scratch the pirate itch for another 100 years, Lisa?
Part three is in the can and it leaves you hanging. You know immediately at the end of this movie that it is leading to something else, probably even longer and splashier. That I can promise.
Oh boy, the Jolly Roger is still waving. Lisa Schwartzbaum with Entertainment Weekly. Great to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Bailina Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Christina Russo, Karen Schiffman, and Roya Wolverson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.